From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. The ethnic fighting in the Balkans is tragic. Mordecai Richler says the ethnic split in Canada is absurd. On today's Fresh Air, we talk with Richler, one of Canada's most celebrated novelists. He's the author of The Apprenticeship of Judy Kravitz and Joshua Then and Now. His new book examines the French separatist movement in Quebec. Also today, body traps. We talk with the founder of the Eating Disorders Clinic at Yale, Dr. Judith Roden. Her new book examines the distorted body images that many women have of themselves. And TV critic David Bianculli previews the latest collaboration between David Lynch and Mark Frost, the pair that gave us Twin Peaks. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. The Supreme Court ruled today that defense lawyers, like prosecutors, are barred from using race as a basis for excluding individuals from serving on a jury. NPR's Nina Totenberg reports.
In 1986, the Supreme Court ruled for the first time that prosecutors may not strike potential jurors based on race. The question left for resolution was whether the ban on race-conscious jury strikes applied to the defense as well as the prosecution. Today, the Supreme Court answered, yes, it does. The case before the justices involved three whites accused of beating an African American, and today the Supreme Court ruled that the defense may not exclude blacks from serving on the jury. Writing for the court majority, Justice Harry Blackmun said, be it at the hands of the state or the defense. If a court allows jurors to be excluded because of group bias, it is a willing participant in a scheme that could only undermine the very foundation of our system of justice, our citizens' confidence in it. The vote was 7-2, but Chief Justice Rehnquist and Justice Clarence Thomas went along with the majority only reluctantly, noting that today's ruling was dictated by previous decisions. Still, Thomas, the court's only black member, said the court and the country's minorities would one day rue the decision. Justices Scalia and O'Connor dissented, with Scalia calling the majority opinion terminally absurd. I'm Nina Totenberg in Washington.
The Supreme Court has upheld California's property tax system, which imposes sharply higher property taxes on new homeowners than it does on longtime residents. The suit was brought by a homebuyer who charged that the system unconstitutionally discriminates against new property owners. By a vote of 8-1, the High Court ruled that the state has a right to use its tax system to favor continuity and stability in the ownership of homes and businesses. 29 black plaintiffs filing suit against the state of Georgia reached an out-of-court settlement today that will change the state's current method of selecting judges. Anna Marie Hartman of Peach State Public Radio reports.
The lawsuit was brought against the state in 1988, charging that the current system of choosing judges dilutes black voting strength. Georgia will now abandon contested judicial elections in favor of a system that will allow the governor to appoint the state's judges, then let voters decide every 4 years whether to retain or dismiss each judge. The key plaintiff in the case is State Representative Tyrone Brooks, who says the new document will guarantee fairness for blacks in Georgia.
This is a monumental, historic agreement, because Georgia will become number one in the nation at the end of 1994 in the number of African Americans serving in the judiciary.
The agreement will now be submitted to the U.S. Justice Department for approval. For National Public Radio, I'm Anna Marie Hartman in Atlanta.
On Wall Street today, the Dow Jones Industrial Average lost more than 13 points to close at 3,274. Declines led advances by almost 2-1. This is NPR. A U.S. official said today that the United States has agreed to drop about $30 million in claims against the former Soviet Union for bugging its new embassy in Moscow. The Reuters news agency reported that the agreement was part of a deal with Russia, whereby the United States will get a piece of land in Moscow where it can build a new embassy. The deal would also allow the United States to keep a long-term lease on the existing American embassy in Moscow, valued at $45 million. The Russians will get a piece of property in Washington, where a new embassy built by the former Soviet government has lain vacant for several years because of the dispute. Undeclared presidential candidate Ross Perot began a campaign swing through California today. In Sacramento, Perot addressed supporters who'd helped gather more than 1 million signatures to put his name on the ballot. Steve Scott filed this report.
Perot addressed thousands of screaming supporters at what's believed to be the largest candidate rally at the California State Capitol in nearly a decade. Drawing on his standard stump speech, Perot implied he had forced the major party candidates to become more responsive to the public.
The president had a press conference. Governor Clinton is on television playing the saxophone. And Vice President Cuello is trying to figure out how to spell potato.
The signatures submitted were well above the 135,000 needed to qualify him in California. Perot's Sacramento appearance followed meetings with minority representatives designed to counter criticisms that his insurgent candidacy is directed at whites only. For National Public Radio, this is Steve Scott in Sacramento.
Election officials in Ireland said there was a low turnout today in the country's referendum on the new Treaty of European Union. Irish leaders have lobbied hard in the past few weeks to get voters to approve the Maastricht Treaty, which would tighten economic and political ties within the European community. The count in the Irish vote is not due to begin until tomorrow morning, and analysts say the result is wide open. I'm Corey Flintoff, NPR News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. The former republics of Yugoslavia are at war. Czechoslovakia may split in two. Meanwhile, there's a split that may happen much closer to home, right across the border in Canada. The French-speaking nationalist movement in Quebec is trying to preserve its language and culture. Quebec could conceivably secede from Canada to protect that culture against assimilation into the English-speaking Canadian mainstream. A referendum this fall may decide the country's future. A little later, we'll hear from Lise Bissonnette, the publisher and editor of the French-Canadian newspaper Le Devoir. First, Mordecai Richler joins us. He was born in Montreal and now lives in the eastern townships of Quebec. His novels like The Apprenticeship of Judy Kravitz, Joshua Then and Now, and Solomon Gursky Was Here have made him one of Canada's most celebrated novelists. He describes his new book as a requiem for his divided country. It's called O Canada, O Quebec.
Well, I think what's happening in the Balkans is truly tragic. What we're going through here is farcical, but we're stage center, so it's not as amusing as it is for outsiders. It strikes me as a totally unnecessary and goofy crisis because Francophones and Quebec are actually the best treated minority in the world. They have their own civil code here and language protections. And English Canada, it seems to me, has acted as a buffer and committed partner, and many people in English Canada cherish French Canadian culture. Had Quebec been an American state rather than a Canadian province, Francophone culture probably would have gone the way of Louisiana 100 years ago, which would have been a considerable loss to all of us. However, Francophones feel very vulnerable. They only make up 2% of the North American population. And at times, I'm afraid, they're also somewhat paranoid about the situation.
Well, one of the things that you criticize in your new book is the language law now in Quebec. Would you describe what the law does?
Well, the language law is rather bizarre. It's only one clause in a language bill called Bill 101, which did some worthwhile things. It certified that French would be the language of the workplace in a province where Francophones are the majority. However, then there were vengeful clauses or ridiculous clauses in the bill, and the one that irritated Anglophones beyond belief was a law called Bill 178, which outlawed English or bilingual commercial signs on the street, and then went to ridiculous measures inside, saying you could have English signs if there were only half as many as the French signs, or if the print was half the size, or if the colors were not more enticing than they were in French. And so it all became rather absurd, and it's a great embarrassment to a good many Francophones, in fact, to the majority of Francophones.
So there are a lot of English-speaking shop owners who have to put up signs in French now.
Well, they don't object. I should point out that English-speaking shop owners do not object to putting up signs in French or to being bilingual. They just want to be able to have bilingual signs, which is something which seems to me very civil attitude or notion.
For people who want to preserve a culture, what do you think is wrong by doing it through language laws?
Well, I have nothing against preserving French culture as long as it doesn't stifle or attempt to stifle the other cultures in this province. So there are certain measures necessary that have to be taken in order to preserve French culture, but a lot of them were in place anyway, in that there were language laws here. There is a different civil code in Quebec. And Francophones are entitled to speak in French in Parliament. There are all kinds of things in place. I don't object, I should repeat, to certain measures in Bill 101, significantly the one making French the language of the workplace. But other measures in it are ridiculous.
What do you think the differences between the English-speaking and the French-speaking really are in Quebec? I mean, is this just about language and culture? Or are there things happening beneath the surface, do you think?
Well, it's an old quarrel. And you know, there are complaints or case to answer in that for years. Francophones in this province felt they were treated as second-class citizens and as, you know, a cheap labor force. And there was something in that. And Anglophones control the economic levers of this province. Now, that is no longer, that was not just, but it hasn't been the case for years. I mean, and I should say that the economic levers are now happily in Francophone hands, and that for 27 of the last 33 years, the prime minister of this country has come from Quebec. So Quebec is being very well treated and would be even more vulnerable as a so-called independent state.
Do you think there's any xenophobia at work here since more and more immigrants are coming to Canada?
Yes, there's a big sea change coming in this country in both English and French Canada. At the moment, 40% of Canadians are of neither French nor English extraction. And surely in the next 10, 20 years, they will become a majority. And that's going to make for a huge change in Canada. We now have many Central Americans, Vietnamese, Haitians, West Indians, Indians in this country, and certainly Toronto, which was once a very dour, unyielding Orangeman city, has been vastly improved by this immigration. But the country's changing.
Mm-hmm. There's a referendum coming up on October 26th. Exactly what will people be voting on?
Well, first of all, I should explain, we don't know what the question will be. The Francophone nationalists, those in the Parti Québécois, would like it to be on whether Quebec should opt for sovereignty or not. The Liberal government, which is in power, is more likely to pose the question based on the federal offer of so-called renewed federalism. What I would be apprehensive or worry about in the referendum is that it would only be 53 or 54% for federalism, in which case nationalist Francophones are likely to say that they've been deprived of their patrimony by les autres, meaning the Anglophones and allophones. Allophones is an unfortunate term which covers Greeks, Italians, and Portuguese, and so on. But last time it was 60-40. We had the referendum in 1980 on a very weak question, but it was 60-40 for federalism. I don't think Quebec will separate. And Parizeau, Jacques Parizeau, who is a very intelligent man, is the leader of the Parti Québécois, keeps backtracking. He's now said if Quebec becomes independent, we will still have, because I'm a Quebecer, we will still have Canadian passports and Canadian money. And a local comic, a very astute comic, has responded by saying, well, we already have that. Why do we need independence?
So you're pretty confident that Quebec won't secede?
I'm confident that Quebec won't secede, but we could have problems in that very nationalists who are committed to this cause, and it's not an evil one, I think it's just a misconceived one, have worked very, very hard on this. And up to about 18 months ago, they believed the table was set for them, and now they're not going to be, in my opinion, invited to sit down and eat. So there could be some bitterness and acrimony in Quebec afterwards. The last referendum split up families. People didn't talk to each other for years, and it's just a gut-wrenching business.
How have the language laws affect your day-to-day life? Have they affected it at all?
We're dealing with symbols. I don't really know. It would be unfair to say it's affected my daily life or anyone's daily life. It's just a great irritant and kind of vengeful and unnecessary, and it makes people feel unwelcome here, which is not a very good thing.
Are you bilingual?
I'm not as bilingual as I should be, but when we returned in 1972 after 20 years abroad, we put all of our children into French schools, French language schools.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
How come?
Well, I just thought it would be the best thing for them. I'm much more useful to be able to speak French than to learn algebra, and that it would make the two great Western cultures accessible to them. So I regret that my own French is deficient. I can read it. I don't speak it very well. But I certainly wanted my children to be bilingual.
Mm-hmm. Mordecai Richler, I understand your book, O Canada, O Quebec, Requiem for a Divided Country, has been very controversial in Quebec. Were there attempts to ban the book?
Well, no, there was a silly business where there were two. We have a party in Ottawa called the Bloc Québécois, which is a secessionist party made up of discontented conservatives and liberals who have formed a bloc in Parliament. Now, they're led by a very appealing and cultivated man called Lucien Bouchard. However, two of his backbenchers, I think to the embarrassment of Bouchard, got up and demanded my book be banned because I was a racist and a hate monger. And of course, they hadn't read the book. They've never read the book. Lucien Bouchard dissociated himself from them. And I was very pleased to see that.
Where are the civil libertarians?
I'm sorry, what?
Where's the civil liberties movement? You know, I mean, here's this movement that's saying you have to keep all your signs in one language.
Yes.
Where's the civil liberties movement?
Well, there's a residue of Anglophone guilt in this country, I think, and also issue envy. So they would react to this kind of thing happening in Puerto Rico or Guatemala or Louisiana, but they haven't reacted to it happening in Quebec.
I know you think that Quebec probably won't secede, but you point out if it did, one of the great paradoxes could be that it would be forced to speak English to kind of appease America, which, as a small country, it would probably have to do.
That's right. I think, ironically, that if Quebec became truly independent with its own money and its own passports and whatever, it would have to be much more bilingual than it is right now.
Mordecai Richler, thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you very much.
Mordecai Richler's new book is O Canada, O Quebec, Requiem for a Divided Country. He joined us from the CBC in Montreal. Coming up, a talk with a French nationalist. This is Fresh Air. Obviously, Canadian francophones disagree with Richler when he calls the divisions in Canada ridiculous. We phoned the editor and publisher of the Canadian-French newspaper Le Devoir, Lise Bissonnette. She's written editorials in support of the French nationalist movement. She says the movement is about more than preserving the French language.
Quebec has a very different vision of its role in Canada, of its historical role and its future within Canada. People in Quebec, and now I'm speaking mostly of the French-speaking population, though it's not exclusive, have a tendency and a conviction that Quebec is a place, a bit a quasi-country in a way, and they relate much more to their Quebec government than they do to the Canadian government. So that's something very deep, in fact, which stems from the fact that Quebecers mostly think of themselves as a founding nation in this country, as you know, and I think everybody knows. Well, if you look at how Canada has evolved today, and the perception in English Canada is totally different than our perception in Quebec, Canada is now has been peopled over the years by a number of other people coming from other nations, mostly from Europe, but also from Asia recently and places like that, and thinks of itself today as a sort of large multicultural nation where the French are just the largest ethnic minority in a way.
Isn't the reality, though, that countries like the United States, like Canada, are becoming more multicultural?
Well, obviously, and Quebec itself is becoming much, much more multicultural than it used to be.
But it seems to me that part of what the French-speaking people of Quebec want is to prevent it from becoming more multicultural.
Absolutely not. I mean, absolutely not. Quebec has the most open immigration policy that there is in maybe in Canada, is welcoming immigrants. That's official policy. And Quebec has all sorts of, you know, if you look at, for example, at the status of the English in Quebec as a minority, I mean, because they are a minority in Quebec, they're the most pampered minority in Canada. The only thing that they don't have is that English is not an official language in Quebec, but other than that, all their institutions, schools, universities, health, services and whatever surpassed by any measure whatever the rest of Canada has consented, as agreed to, for example, for the French-speaking minority or for any other minority. So Quebec is, if you look at what Quebec is today, it is a multicultural society, but that doesn't have to translate into any kind of constitutional arrangement. If you compare that with the United States, for example, do you have in the American Constitution anything saying that, you know, this is a multicultural society and it should be put in stone in the Constitution and things like that?
Let me ask you what you think of the language law which prohibits English signs on commercial establishments.
I think that, you know, if you look at what language rights are, wherever, you know, if you look at Bill of Rights around the world, you will, and even the United Nations and places like that, you'll find that language rights are not among basic rights. They're very different from freedom of expression, for example, or freedom of religion and things like that. I mean, this is simply a law that says that commercially you cannot put a sign in English or any other language for that matter. It is supposed to be only in French Montreal. A vast number of countries around the world have language laws.
So you don't think it limits another group's civil liberties if they can't put up a sign in their own language?
No, really not. I mean, it is not a question. It is something that is almost technical, but it's been blown up out of proportion. You know, for years, this law was passed in 1974 for the first time, and then in 77 amended. And for years, you never heard a word about it, except that one government that was elected at one point promised that it would change it, and then it became a sort of a big, big fight. But you know, even among the English community in Montreal, you'll find very diverse views about this law. A lot of people don't care about it, but some, and of course, those who are very politically minded and who disagree on other things with the Quebec government have sort of overblown it. But at some point, I mean, you just don't look at where was the root of this conflict. It is a real conflict right now. It is really tough, and it's not so much a question of civil liberties as of, you know, people fighting their own war over this law, and it's sort of out of hand today.
you're bilingual. You speak English fluently, as we're hearing now. What is the threat of having signs up in English as well as in French?
Oh, it's a question. It's mostly a question of symbolism. Of course, Montreal is probably the most bilingual city in North America, and I shouldn't say probably. It is. In fact, the whole province of Quebec is more bilingual on any day than any other province in Canada, which is, by the way, legally and officially bilingual. But in practice, if you travel outside of the Quebec province, you won't find many people who are that bilingual. So we are more bilingual in a way, and we have this law that says that we are officially unilingual.
Tell me why French means so much to you, why it's such an important political and symbolic issue for you.
Well, it is deep. I mean, what can you find? That's deeper than language for identity. Today, cultural identity is something that is influenced by, you know, mass culture throughout the world. I mean, if you're in Africa, if you're in Europe, whatever, I mean, you're watching American television and sort of absorbing Disneyland and all of this. So we're like all the others in Quebec. I mean, culture itself has lost its powerful link with your identity, but language is something very different. Language, that's, you know, there's nothing deeper. Maybe it's difficult for English-speaking people to understand that as much as we do, because English is the international language, while French is second, maybe internationally, but has lost its status in the world. And so, but that's something absolutely deep. I mean, English is my second language, of course, and I would like to speak two or three or four more languages, but French is my mother tongue, and that's true for 6 million of Quebecers. And also, but they've created this province, and then we've been here, you know, for very long, and we want this to go on in French. People are not about to give up after having succeeded. All these adverse conditions over centuries, they're not about to give up that fight.
Would you like to see Quebec secede?
Oh, well, I'm personally, given what Canada is becoming today, yes. Yes, I'm looking at the present constitutional crisis and what's on the table and the future of Canada as it is now being designed as we talk. I mean, as you know, it's not finished. These discussions are not finished. But the kind of Canada that English Canada has decided that it wants will be even more constraining for Quebec. So I'm not a sovereigntist in the sense that I've never been a militant, never been a member of a political party. And I like to think of myself as basically a journalist first. But when I look at all of this, I don't think that Canada, as it is now being designed, will be a good thing for Quebec. And I think that it's going to be even more constraining for the province. So all in all, yes, I would go for secession. Nevertheless, you won't find many pure secessionists in Quebec. I mean, we all know what's happening in Europe. We're all looking for formulas. That wouldn't be, it's not possible today to think of sovereignty, pure and tough sovereignty. I mean, with no links, this is not the basic Quebec view. But people want more power for their provincial government, and the fact is that the way it's going right now, it's not going to happen, so we'll have to make a decision.
What are your problems with what the Canadian government is planning, or the direction the Canadian government or the Canadian constitution is heading in?
Basically, what Quebec has been asking is a new division of powers between the federal and the provincial government that would give some more control to Quebec over its own affairs. And what Canada has been proposing right now is something totally different, almost nothing under new division of powers. And they're proposing a new federal institution that would be a Senate, on close to the model of the American Senate, but for us in Quebec, it's a sort of a second House of Commons in Ottawa, so it's sort of reinforcing the federal power over us. And so in a way, it's a very contradictory with what Quebec has been asking for years. So that's the problem right now.
Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you.
Lise Bissonnette is the editor and publisher of the French-Canadian newspaper Le Devoir. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Thank you.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Mirror, mirror on the wall, who's the fattest one of all? Dr. Judith Roden says more and more women of average size are worried sick about their weight. Dr. Judith Roden is the founder of the Eating Disorders Clinic at Yale and the author of the new book, Body Traps. We'll talk about some of the latest developments in the American obsession with body image. And good news for David Lynch fans, this Saturday a new David Lynch series premieres on ABC. TV critic David Bianculli has a preview. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. In Washington, the U.S. Supreme Court has upheld California's tax provision that benefits longtime property owners over more recent buyers. NPR's Nina Totenberg reports.
In 1978, California taxpayers revolted against higher taxes. They put the lid on what the state could impose in the way of property taxes. One provision of the law, known as Proposition 13, was to roll back taxes to the 1975 level, cap increases at 2% a year, and to tax property bought after 1978 based on the selling price. The result was wildly disparate property taxes for many people. Stephanie Nordlinger, for instance, bought a house in 1988 and paid $170,000 for it. Her taxes were assessed on the basis of that selling price, whereas comparable neighborhood homes were assessed at $32,000 because they were bought in 1975. Nordlinger challenged the provision in court, but today the Supreme Court upheld the tax scheme by an 8-1 vote. I'm Nina Totenberg at the Supreme Court.
And the nation's highest court has ruled that attorneys of defendants in criminal cases may not use race to rule out potential jurors. In a 7-2 vote, the high court broadened an earlier court ruling that barred similar exclusions by prosecutors. Writing for the court, Justice Harry Blackmun found that if a court allows jurors to be excluded because of group bias, it is a willing participant in a scheme that could only undermine the very foundation of the nation's system of justice and confidence in it. On Capitol Hill, the House has approved a bill that would provide $1.3 billion of emergency aid to victims of the Los Angeles rioting and the flooding in Chicago, as well as money for summer jobs programs. The Senate has now begun debate on the bill. NPR's Mara Liasson reports.
The bill is a compromise reached after negotiations between the White House and Congress. Congressional negotiators had held out for a $2 billion package that would have included money for Head Start, school programs, a big summer jobs component, and crime prevention. But the White House threatened a veto. An agreement was finally reached on legislation that would provide $500 million for summer jobs and about $500 million for disaster loans and grants for businesses and property owners hurt by the Los Angeles riot and the Chicago flood. The legislation declares a budgetary emergency. That means the assistance funds will be paid for by borrowing, adding the cost to the federal deficit. At the Capitol, I'm Mara Liasson.
In New York City on Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials moved down over 13 points to close at 3,274.15 on volume of 215 million shares. Declining issues led advances by a margin of 2-1. This is National Public Radio News. U.S. officials are said to have given up claims amounting to $30 million against the former Soviet Union. The Reuters news agency, quoting a U.S. official, says, as part of a new agreement with Moscow, Washington has agreed to drop claims against the former Soviet Union for bugging its new embassy in Russia. The official says in exchange, Washington will get a piece of land to build a new embassy in Moscow and a long-term lease on the present embassy building there. Just one day after Russian President Boris Yeltsin paid a visit to Capitol Hill, Senate Majority Leader George Mitchell predicted immediate action on aid to the former Soviet Union. NPR's Elizabeth Arnold reports.
Senator Mitchell told reporters today that legislation providing authorization for technical, humanitarian, and other aid to the former Soviet republics will be considered by the Senate as early as next week. The House Appropriations Committee has already passed a foreign aid bill that includes $400 million in assistance to the former Soviet Union, which is the amount the Bush administration favors. Mitchell said Secretary of State James Baker called him today to urge immediate action on the measure. Yesterday, Russian President Boris Yeltsin made a pitch to lawmakers in a special joint meeting of Congress. Yeltsin's plea for assistance was warmly received, although many lawmakers favor funding domestic initiatives before extending aid to the former Cold War adversary. I'm Elizabeth Arnold in Washington.
A U.S. team traveled to a Russian prison today looking for clues about the fate of a U.S. pilot shot down during the Korean War. However, the military man in charge of 10 labor camps in the region said there are no Americans in them. This week, Russian President Boris Yeltsin said American POWs held in prison in the former Soviet Union might still be in Russia. A State Department spokesman said a commission had received information about an American POW might have been at a camp as recently as 18 months ago. Former Soviet leader Gorbachev has denied any information. This is National Public Radio News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. Are you always dieting or thinking about beginning again? And on top of that, do you feel ashamed of the fact that you spend time worrying about how you look? This is the type of problem my guest Dr. Judith Roden deals with. She's the founding director of the Eating Disorders Clinic at Yale University and a professor of psychology and medicine at Yale Medical School. In her new book, Body Traps, Dr. Roden offers advice on how to break an obsession with body image. I asked her if she thinks there's a growing movement against dieting.
Oh, absolutely. I think that health professionals are contributing to the anti-dieting movement because they're seeing increasing evidence that most diets don't work. There's also an anti-dieting movement that's occurring among women and some men in the society who feel that they've dieted so many times and most often regained it, and they find that dieting isn't the answer to weight control that they had hoped. So from many quarters, there's questions about the efficacy of dieting and the rationality of dieting if, in fact, it isn't efficacious.
So you think that there's a kind of popular anti-dieting movement, I mean, a movement of people who, I shouldn't say movement, it's not like they're organized necessarily, but it's not just coming from the expert, it's also from the people who diet.
Absolutely. And I think it's because it's coming from so many different quarters that people are starting to take it seriously.
Mm-hmm. Is dieting often a cause of weight gain in the long run?
We think dieting and regaining and dieting and regaining, what we call yo-yo dieting or weight cycling, is indeed a cause of regain. It may not be the only one, but there certainly are very good data suggesting that it is one cause. Biochemical changes occur in the body that make it easier to store fat with each successive cycle of gaining and losing. There may be metabolic changes, and there certainly are changes in taste preferences. We find that people who are repeated weight cyclers tend increasingly to prefer foods that are high in fat, and these are the foods that have higher caloric density and are more easily stored as fat. So there are a variety of mechanisms by which weight cycling is tending to lead to problems, and all of those lead towards greater weight gain and greater fat deposition.
I'd like to get a sense of where you think we are now. What types of problems are you seeing the most of at the Yale Eating Disorders Clinic?
Well, we're seeing anorexia and bulimia in about the same numbers that we saw before, but what we're seeing much more of are women who are of relatively normal weight, who are just so intensely preoccupied by their body and their body image that they feel it saps energy from all of their other life pursuits and really threatens their self-esteem and sense of self-worth. I mean, these women get up and their sense of self rises and falls on what the scale says each morning, and they realize that they need help.
So these are women who have enough consciousness to realize that they don't want to be obsessed with their body image, but they are anyways.
That's right. There is a fine line, I think, between concern with body in a normal and healthy way. We are concerned about fitness. We're concerned about what we eat. And there are many good data suggesting that health is improved by attention in these areas. But I think the women who go over that edge and become so intensely preoccupied with their weight and where weight becomes a metaphor for themselves and how good or bad they are. And that's the point that many of these women get into problems. Not all of them understand that this is a problem and seek help, or not all of them understand that there is really help to be had for this. So many women live in this kind of, with these feelings in a kind of shameful, self-imposed isolation.
If there's perhaps a decrease in dieting now, do you think that dieting in a way is being replaced by plastic surgery? Because it seems to me plastic surgery is on the rise.
Oh, plastic surgery is enormously on the rise. Liposuction has gone up 300% as a surgical procedure in the last 4 years. So I think you're quite right. If we start to see that the health consequences of dieting are such that physicians and health practitioners aren't recommending it, and anyway, the general population is finding that it doesn't work, it's not that they're saying, well, let's not do that. Let's get more relaxed about our bodies and tolerate a greater diversity of weight, just like we tolerate a greater diversity of height. Instead, they're just looking for other fixes. Cosmetic surgery is one fix. Craziness about the degree of exercise is another kind of fix. Purging is another kind of fix, and I think that is why we see the contagion of bulimia that is often prevalent in some subgroups in American society. So I wish people would just have looked at the dieting data and said, that's not for me. I think I'll just get more relaxed rather than let me find the next fix.
Mm-hmm. My guest is Dr. Judith Roden, and she directs the Yale Eating Disorders Clinic. We're going to take a short break, and then we'll talk some more. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guest is Dr. Judith Roden, and she's a professor of psychology and medicine at Yale Med School, and she also directs the Yale Eating Disorders Clinic. As you point out in your book, the people coming of age today are the children of the Weight Watchers generation. Do you think that children of parents who have been watching their weight and who have been self-conscious about their weight are more likely to be self-conscious about their own weight?
Yes, I do, and there are a variety of routes by which that occurs. First of all, we have a great deal of data suggesting that girls who are the most eating disordered, not who are clinically disordered, but are just have very disordered eating, have mothers who think the daughters are less attractive than the daughters even do themselves. So we see that these are daughters of mothers who are concerned not only about their own weight, but also about the weights of their children and are either directly or indirectly influencing the daughters to feel less good about themselves. There are also very good data from work by Stephen Resnick and my group at Yale suggesting that women who are weight preoccupied feed their children with more anxiety, more ambivalence, and more emotion than women who are not weight preoccupied. And these are data looking at children who are 1 year old. The women are all themselves normal weight in this study, and the children are all lean. And we actually measure and rate the feeding interactions, and we compare it to the play interactions. So it's not that the mothers are overall more anxious. It's very specific to the feeding situation. And it's much more true of their feeding interactions with their daughters than with their sons.
How do you teach people to learn to view themselves less critically?
There are a variety of ways. Often, if someone doesn't like her or his body in total, we try to get them to find a part of their body that they're more satisfied with. And it's often the case that people can do that. Someone likes the shape of their foot or finds their hands okay, even though they don't like other aspects of their bodies. We get them to focus on those first and try to do things that are supportive of that part of their body, so creams or eye solutions, if it's their eyes that they like better, to try to get them to focus in the mirror or by looking at parts of their body that they like, treat them well, and then move on to other areas. It sounds fairly simple and in some ways somewhat trivial, but there are many people who put their bodies on hold until they get them to the point where they like them better, and they're, since many of them never get to that point, they find themselves not doing the things for their bodies that would allow them to both gain greater body awareness and also learn to treat themselves better. So we start in small increments to, I mean, that's just one of many kinds of exercises.
One piece of advice I know you often give people is to take your current self, your current body, more seriously than the ideal self, the ideal body that you're striving for. What's that advice about?
One of the reasons that people get into problems with shame in particular is that they have a very large gap between self and ideal. And shame comes from that, from feeling that somehow you're left wanting in this real not fulfilling the ideal self. And so if we get more satisfaction with the real self at the same time working on developing an ideal self that's more realistic and perhaps more attainable, we begin to reduce the shame that many women experience and help them to get on with their lives and feel better about themselves. The women who get in the most trouble are the ones who are most perfectionistic, because they have very strong ideals and they're constantly striving and driving themselves to attain those ideals. So those perfectionistic women are ones with whom we work most particularly in this area.
When you're working with people with eating disorders, do you feel like you should get into a social critique with them? You know, talking about how the media affects your self-image and talking about body image as a feminist issue, things along those lines.
In treatment, we'll let women raise those issues, but certainly one can't treat women for weight-related concerns without these issues being addressed and brought up spontaneously by these women. Many feel that they are caught by society standards imposing themselves on them. What we help them to do is understand these standards and the context of them, but to also understand that they don't have to fall prey to them if, in fact, they work towards a greater sense of self-awareness and self-understanding. We do this, though, in the context of validating that thinking about one's body is important, that it is, body image is an important component in self-image, and therefore not making them feel that it's trivial or silly to worry about this.
Is there such a thing as a foodaholic? I've had women say to me, I'm thinking of one in particular who's really very, very successful, that she just can't have food in the house and really has to be very severe in how she restricts her intake of food because she's a foodaholic, and when she starts eating, it's just impossible to stop.
Well, there's no question that there are people who are compulsive eaters, and I've tried, and other people also have looked at what we now call the medicinal effects of food. There's no question that food has metabolic and biological effects. It affects neurotransmitters in the brain. And it may be for different people that food really does turn them on in different ways. Those are new data that I think do suggest, although we wouldn't use necessarily in science the metaphor foodaholic, that there are people who are differentially turned on by food.
So what would the solution be for them, to not eat? I mean, you can't exactly do that. You could starve yourself.
No, it's not true of all foods. So what people have to find out are what are the foods that lead to this kind of turn on. For many, it's carbohydrates. And for many, it's carbohydrates at certain times of the day. So there are it's important to examine more critically one's eating and to determine the time of day and the kinds of foods in order to see where you may need to restrain only certain types of things at certain times of day.
Mm-hmm. Now, some people who want to lose weight skip meals. And you suggest that that's not a very good idea in the long run, not only because you're depriving yourself of nutrition, but you're actually lowering your metabolism, and it might work against losing weight in the long run.
That's right. That's especially true in the morning. They most often skip breakfast, and it's very important to start the day with breakfast, not for the old saw reasons that our mothers told us, but because it really does give a kick start to metabolism, which has slowed down during the night when we're sleeping. There is evidence that scattering calories over the course of the day has a better metabolic effect and actually burns more calories than eating the same number of calories during fewer meals. So it's especially important to not slow down to where you're just eating one big meal a day, which is the worst thing to do metabolically.
You are an expert in the area of eating disorders. Do you have any of the symptoms yourself that, you've described? Have you ever, really obsessed on body image or tried to diet or, just been very self-conscious about the way you eat or what you eat or how you look? Any of this stuff?
Sure. I mean, I've done a great deal of research both on the psychology and biology of obesity and eating disorders and weight regulation. And also I'm a woman. So I think it's endemic to being a woman to be attentive to and worried about one's weight. And but I've not had any of the more major problems that I talk about.
So basically what you're saying is you think that some of the stuff is kind of unavoidable in our culture.
Oh, I think it's quite unavoidable at the moment in our culture. And I've written this book to try to get people to avoid it, to think in a more healthy way about themselves and their bodies and their eating. This isn't the only culture. I mean, bodies and beauty have been a preoccupation of women and for women for generations. The foot binding of the early Chinese, the wearing of corsets in the Scarlet O'Hara kind of Civil War era. I mean, all of these were ways for women to fulfill whatever the beauty ideal was at the moment. So I think we're missing some of the point if we just focus as a blame on modern society or the current beauty industry or the current media. We miss the point that body has always been the domain in which women have had to play a central role in worrying about themselves.
Dr. Roden, thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Dr. Judith Roden is the founding director of the Eating Disorders Clinic at Yale and the author of the new book, Body Traps. This is Fresh Air. Let's check in with Linda Wertheimer and see what's coming up on All Things Considered. Hi, Linda.
Hi, Terry. We have a report tonight from South Africa. A number of women and children were killed in a township near Johannesburg during the night. And we have another report from Dobrinja. That's the old Olympic village in Bosnia. It's been under siege for about 2 months, but we got a telephone call in to a woman who lives there. She talks about what it's been like. Closer to home, the Congress seems to be prepared to close down the Super Collider, which is under construction. We'll have a couple of pieces on what that might mean, and talk to a woman in Hannibal, Missouri, who has gradually come around to being pro-abortion.
Thanks, Linda. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. David Lynch and Mark Frost gave plenty of people plenty to talk about with their TV series Twin Peaks. This weekend, they're back on ABC with a new series, this time a sitcom set during the so-called golden age of live TV. TV critic David Bianculli, who was a Peaks freak from start to finish, has this review.
If you hated Twin Peaks from the start, or were really tired of it by the end, On the Air probably isn't for you. That's because, though On the Air is played totally for laughs, it's not played at all straight. Imagine a surrealistic backstage version of your show of shows. It's got as many sight gags as Police Squad, as many oddball moments as Twin Peaks, and even some of the same performers. Miguel Ferrer, who played the abrasive FBI agent Albert in Twin Peaks, plays an equally abrasive network executive in On the Air, an executive for the low-rent Zablotnik Broadcasting Company. Ian Buchanan, who played Deputy Andy's rival for Lucy's affections, plays the even more conceited Lester Guy, a washed-up movie star making his TV debut as the star of the ZBC's first live program. And David L. Lander, who played the guy who ran the Twin Peaks beauty pageant, plays the TV show's director. So if you like Twin Peaks and miss it, you'll be happy to see these folks again, even in this very different setting. On the Air has no laugh track. It has a very strange sense of humor and its own sense of timing. In the pilot, written by Lynch and Frost and directed by Lynch, the entire first half is used to set up the laughs delivered in the second. So if you want to get a feel for On the Air, you have to watch it to the very end, even though you can get a hint of it from the very beginning. That's thanks to the irreverent theme music by Angelo Badalamenti, who wrote the music for Twin Peaks. On the Air is so intensely visual, bright, and gaudy, there's not much I can play on the radio to give you a sense of what it's like. But here's one weird sample, and even it takes some explaining. The show's director, Mr. Gokhtek, has such a thick accent that his assistant Ruth, played by Nancy Ferguson, has to interpret for him. Marvin Kaplan plays the show's nervous producer, who tries but fails to understand what his director is saying. And Marla Jeanette Rubinoff plays Betty, the female star of the show within a show, and a woman who doesn't understand what anybody is saying.
Mr. Gokhtek.
Es Gokhtek, Betty. Gokhtek.
Sir, when would you like me to rehearse the kitchen scene?
Who is your name? Your ironing.
How is your ironing?
Betty, how is your ironing?
My mother does my ironing.
But Betty, your mother is knit on the sun.
My mother's at home.
And how is your mother, you poor girl?
Well, she's excited, but honestly, Mr. Gokhtek, if my mother has to iron, she's gonna miss the show tonight.
But she can watch it on the television in her own home.
But it's in the other room and the cord doesn't reach.
I think Betty thinks you want her mother to do some ironing, when in fact what you're referring to is the ironing that takes place only within the confines of the scene, which is the ironing you're going to be doing, Betty, with the iron you have in your hand. Oh, sorry.
Frost and Lynch seem to be having lots of fun this time around, and by the end of the pilot, that sense of silliness and enjoyment is infectious. But does ABC like it? I don't think so. The network has scheduled On the Air to premiere and run on Saturday night, which is where it banished Twin Peaks shortly before taking it off the air. With a summertime Saturday night time slot, On the Air is all but dead on arrival. So catch it soon and tape it carefully. Entertaining as it is, On the Air won't live up to its title for long.
David Bianculli is TV critic for the New York Post and author of the new book, Teleliteracy. Our senior producer this week is Fred Landerl. Our engineers are Audrey Voblaitis, Thad Kirk, and Richard Parker. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Roberta Shurrock directs the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and by this and other NPR member stations. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
This year's campaigning has brought to the surface Americans' dissatisfaction with politics and politicians. On the next Fresh Air, we ask a former presidential candidate for his critique of the campaign process. My guest will be Paul Tsongas. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.
Saturday, partly cloudy. Again, a chance of showers, high in the upper 70s. Stay tuned for All Things Considered.